I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This episode of Ramble Meets is sponsored by Bet365.
I'm Paul Watson, football traveller and author.
Paul, a very warm welcome to the Football Ramble studio. I've been looking forward to chatting to you for quite a long time.
That's nice to hear. Yeah. I don't hear that often.
No, is that right? I'm sure that's not true. I'd like to set the scene for our listeners, if I may, just in case there are some people out there who aren't entirely sure about what you've done so far in your career. About 10 years ago or so, you were a freelance journalist and you decided that you would quite like to become an internationally capped football player. So you started doing some research, and one thing led to another, and you found out that Pohnpei, the tiny island in Micronesia in the South Pacific, needed some help, and you then went on to become a manager of a team 50,000 miles away, whatever it is, on your own, with no real, if you don't mind me saying, no real idea about what you were getting yourself in for.
Yeah, that's probably flattering me.
Okay, right.
Yeah, it sounds bad now I hear it back. It's a weird thing because that is what I did 10 years ago. That was my great plan, was to finally get my international cap by finding the world's lowest ranked team.
How good a footballer were you, or are you?
Really, I was not good enough to be anywhere near professional or even semi-professional.
Right.
But I was also not bad enough for it to be hilariously funny.
Okay, right.
So that was why the delusion was just about possible.
Okay.
Because I would, my response to that was just, I'd always get myself into the most incredible shape. You probably won't believe it looking at me now, but I used to get into incredible shape so I'd at least be the fittest.
Right, okay.
So you'd see a coach looking at me in pre-season, because back in the day I was doing it, coaches usually just did running in pre-season. Yeah. That was still the old school way.
Yeah.
So through all the running, coaches would be looking at me and thinking, I've got someone here.
Okay, right.
Balls would come out. I'll be gone within a few weeks.
Is that right? Okay, right. Okay.
So,
you had enough about you to think, do you know what? There must be a country somewhere that could have me as a player.
Yeah, but I think it's a discussion that lots of people have, maybe almost all football fans have at some point.
Yeah.
The only thing that marked me and my flatmate Matt out from everyone else is we were stupid enough to actually see it through and see it through sober. Because yeah, I think it's the kind of conversation you hear in a pub, you have in a pub. It's, you know, England, Andorra, and you get the kind of, well, we could be playing for Andorra conversations, and yeah, everyone's had them. But
you took that to its natural conclusion.
We took it to its natural conclusion. But as I say, it wasn't sort of like, it's not, if you see this as a sort of feature film, we have that discussion in a pub, the next day we're on a plane. We were crazy enough to spend the next year of our lives sort of digging into it and making it the reality that it was, you know, giving up a job, leaving a girlfriend behind, those kind of things that I think those are probably the only things that marked us out from the millions of other conversations around the world where people have that conversation, they get drunk, they go home, they forget about it.
So why did you settle on Pompeii, which I think is the furthest away you can pretty much get in terms of culture and distance?
Well, yeah, it is more or less. It's about, I suppose it's 26 hours of flying away from here, which is more or less as far as you can go in flight terms.
Yeah.
But actually, it could have been anywhere. This is the funny thing. It could have been, you know, the Vatican, or it could have been Greenland, because what happened was we sort of went down the FIFA rankings like any football fan would do. You think, well, you're looking for the worst team. That's not going to be Andorra necessarily or San Marino. You've got to go right to the bottom. And at that time, you know, you had Bhutan and Montserrat when they played the other final. They were sort of those kind of teams at the bottom.
Yeah.
All of them were clearly better than us. You know, you wouldn't have to scratch far on, you know, the trusty Wikipedia. You'd look through former players, or you'd look through a coach, and you'd find someone in there who's professional or who clearly could sniff us out within minutes.
Yeah.
So we gave up on the FIFA rankings and thought, well, that's a clear sign to sort of get on with our lives.
Yeah.
But quite soon after that, we found the non-FIFA rankings, and that effectively, that moment would change, I guess, the last 10 years of my life, was that we found that there's a lot of places that aren't recognised by FIFA. And whether that's because they're not recognised internationally, whether they're disputed states, whether they've just never had a team, so they've never sort of taken the effort to do it. There's a list, and we went down that list. And we thought by that point, we may as well go to the bottom of that one.
Yeah, okay.
And that was Pompeii, P-O-H-M-P-E-I. And we clicked through the link, and it said on Wikipedia, they're widely regarded as the worst team in the world. They've never won a game. They've just lost on penalties to Yap recently, which is their neighbouring island. And they'd lost 16-1 to Guam in their last sort of big match. So we thought...
And Guam around that time, I believe, were the officially worst ranked team in FIFA for a bit, weren't they?
It's dubious, because the way the rankings work, it's not like there is one definitive worst a lot of the time. There's teams that are sort of tied at the bottom. And there's also, there's quite a lot of movement going on. So Guam had this amazing meteoric rise. You know, they went from being like Pompeii was when I got there, with no real structure, very little in the way of resources, to being now a really decent Asian team.
And that's to do with, because they're a US territory and they're funded by the US.
So they're not actually a model. They're often used as the model for that region. So, you know, you could be like Guam. But in reality, Guam is actually part of the USA. It's not even, it has no status that marks it from the USA, except for the fact it's, you know, a long way away and clearly has a different kind of cultural identity to it. But it's basically part of the US. So in terms of finding funding, they find it much, much easier. And also they were involved in quite a lot of deals in the area that turned out to be quite dodgy.
Right.
The president of their FA was quite recently banned from football.
Right, okay.
But they're in, and they're...
He'll fit in at FIFA then, won't he?
Yeah, he's doing great.
Yeah.
And the other thing that Guam did, which was very clever, was they started scouting in the US for anyone with heritage.
Right.
So a lot of their players, at the time that I was dealing with them, a lot of the players were, you know, Comoro, as they call it. They were from Guam in a very real sense in terms of their heritage, but they were basically in high school in the US, so the level was actually really
good.
Decent.
Okay.
So they went a long way fast.
But you settled on Pompeii.
Yes.
You flew there, it took you 26 hours, four or five different flights, something like that.
Yep.
And you land in Pompeii. You know, it's quite literally the middle of nowhere. It's a completely different cultural experience to anything you've been used to before. We should mention at this point that your flatmate had taken up a role, a slot at a film school out in the US.
Oh, well, he comes with me at the start. So he came with me at the start.
Oh, he came with the first time.
And then we we basically had this sort of trip that was effectively a recce trip.
That's right, of course you did. Apologies,
and
that's right.
Yeah, he came on that one with us, with the guy who'd run football in Pompeii for, I suppose, 10 years, really, who was actually from Uganda. And he, a guy called Charles Musana, and he was the guy that we contacted on this kind of end of this whole find the worst team, play for them. Contacted him, and he said, well, I've just moved to London, so I'm not much used to you.
Right.
So we thought, you know, that's the most ridiculous coincidence. Met him in London, and over a curry, he sort of said, you know, come on, guys. In a very gentle way, he said, come on, lads, you know.
Yeah.
You're not really going to go and play for this team.
Did lots of people say that to you? Did lots of people say, were people kind of starting to get a little bit worried about you because you were very serious about doing it? Clearly you were making all the plans. You and Matt were cracking on. You were trying to find kits. You were trying to find funding. At any point did you think, you know what, this has been great, but I don't know if we can do this?
Less than you think, I think. Right. I mean, once we started the plan in motion, so we spoke to Charles. Charles said, look, you won't get a Micronesian passport. So Pompeii is one of the Micronesian states. Mm-hmm. So it's actually one of four islands that become, you know, officially a nation. So it's Yap, Chuuk, Koshrai and Pompeii.
Koshrai, that's it, yeah.
Now, they're separated by huge stretches of ocean, a lot of them. So it's a really weird thing that they are one nation, but they are. So we were going out to Pompeii and Charles was saying, look, you won't get a Micronesian passport. You have to marry a local, you have to learn the language and you have to renounce your own passport. And even then, you probably won't get one. Mm. So we knew immediately. He said, you know, this moment he said, well, look, if you want to go and coach, the team's pretty much fallen apart. What they need is someone to come in and coach. And he thought, well, I'm not going to do that. Mm. But actually, for me, that moment was a real shift in that, you know, the idea of playing was a bit stupid. And I could see that even objectively at the time. It was a little bit of a kind of dream. And from that moment, really, it was a year of thinking, well, I'm going to go and coach this team. I want to learn everything I can, learn from every coach I've had, really try and work out how to do that. So it wasn't really about playing, which I think probably made things seem a little bit more realistic for other people.
Yeah.
It was less of a kind of party anecdote, and a little bit more like, but honestly, people always laugh, but my biggest worry was someone else would get there first.
Right.
I honestly, if you say really? What I was most scared of was getting off that plane and seeing, I don't know, like seeing some jobbing manager from the sort of, you know, second division English manager out there.
Yeah.
Think, oh.
Alan Kerbishley's
there. Alan Kerbishley.
Yeah.
Because Kerbs needed a job.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Imagine. And then we would be completely ruined because obviously he would see through us. They wouldn't need us and we'd be stuck. So
is it fair to say those fears were unfounded though?
They were very unfounded. When we got there, was one guy who was sort of coaching football who called himself the Chicken Man.
Right.
Guy called Edwin, lovely guy, and had coached football very passionately for years, but had tried to merge it into his other favourite sport, which is wrestling. So he'd created this football wrestling cross.
They were the world leaders in that, presumably.
Yeah, except the sport couldn't be played by anyone who didn't want serious injuries. So yeah, basically we got there and there was a sort of about six people who were playing regularly, maybe 10 or
in total. And how many people were living on the island at the time?
30,000. So it's not tiny. It's people have an image of it as being like, you know, you can walk around it. It's actually relatively large for a sort of small tropical island.
Yeah. There'll be six people out of 30,000 is very, very small. Very
it was a poor ratio.
Yeah.
But this was the thing. We'd gone there thinking, well, we were being told, you know, everyone's really excited. You could be overwhelmed by the number of people. And so I've been thinking, how do you coach 100 people? What do you do for 150 people with a drill?
Yeah.
And that was my problem. I was on the plane drawing up session plans like an idiot, like somebody who's never coached, you know, anyone, trying to draw up a great session plan. If there's 100 people, we get there and there's initially one person, and then after about half an hour, six people, and we just had kick arounds. But gradually they grew and grew and grew over the few weeks we were there. People kind of got to know we were there and came out, and it was chaos. It was unlike any football.
What was the standard?
It was absolutely impossible to define it because the way they played had no real resemblance to how we would play. In some ways it was better. It was, but the pitch is completely flooded. All the time.
Yeah, so I remember when I read this, the pitch, because the climate is so difficult, it's one of the wettest places on earth, right? And you've got literally got frogs jumping all over the pitch.
It's a toad habitat, yeah. Toad habitat that they've put a football pitch on, basically. So it never drains out properly. Really wet place that we'd dismissed, again, in our pre-reading. We thought, well, third wettest in the world, you know, how bad could that be?
Yeah.
Not even in the sort of automatic promotion spot.
Yeah.
But you get there and it's a marsh and it rains like it's the end of the world. And people just get on with it.
Right.
But for us, you know, we'd well-meaningly brought out all these boots. We're like, oh, you know, do you want to borrow some boots?
Yeah.
We're like, what do you, boots? You've got to play barefoot in this.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time you do because it's just so
It's impossible otherwise, yeah.
So, yeah, the football had taken on this sort of form that matched the conditions. And there were also just these other things going on, like, you know, people would occasionally just pick the ball up and boot it into the car park and celebrate. Because, I guess, it was just for fun, just you know, to take the piss, basically.
Right, okay.
But because there was no structure, it was like people were just larking around. So someone would get through on goal and blaze it as high over the bar as they could and sort of celebrate. And we learnt that that sort of came from this psyche in their culture, that there's a terror of failing and being seen to fail.
Right.
It's absolutely like you don't do that. It's taboo. So when faced with a situation where you've got an open goal or a good chance to score, players would often get around that by just clearly trying to miss.
By sort of saying, I can't fail if I don't play.
Exactly. Sort of, they'd blaze it so far over, it's clear they weren't trying, and they'd fall about in hoots of laughter. And that was great until much later on when we were trying to build a more successful sort of football program. Yeah. You don't really want your star striker through on goal thinking, how far can I blaze this?
I don't need any help. I don't do it on purpose. It just happens to me.
Well, that's the thing. I fitted in very well there. Yeah, all I had to do was, instead of doing a sort of angry reaction to my shots, I just had to celebrate.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, style it out. So do you think that you've said that you underestimated the climate. Did you underestimate the cultural differences between what you were expecting and what was the reality?
Yeah, I think I did. I don't think you could overestimated them. Yeah, but I was ready to be an awkward, stumbling foreigner because I think that's sort of who I am. I'm pretty awkward and stumbling in life. So I didn't go over there with a lot of... I would say I wasn't an arrogant kind of person, and that did help me. And I think I knew that I was pretty clueless. But that, again, kind of worked in my favour. I think if I'd been much more professional and slick, but had a bit of an ego, they would have despised me just because that really doesn't fit.
Okay.
Would have been very colonial, you know.
Yeah, of course.
You know, he's the white man, he's putting down cones, you all run around the cones. Never really went that way because I wasn't competent enough to be like that.
So it worked in your favour.
It really did. And a lot of the times what I learned was that the times I was less competent and the times that I sort of tried to do the right thing but botched it, they really liked that and respected it. So, you know, the pitch wasn't marked out. And after a little while, we'd set up a league. We'd got people all around the island to come and play from different community groups in this league.
You had like four teams, didn't you?
We made it up to six in the end.
Right.
And basically, we'd cold called people. We even cold called the Mormons. We went into their hut and said, you know, do you want to come and play?
I remember that bit in the book, and they tried to convert you, right?
Yeah, exactly. We had a sort of nil-nil draw. Right? Like, do you want to play football? No. Do you want to hear about the love of Jesus? No. Nil-nil.
Okay. Nice to see
They did eventually play, though.
Did they?
Yeah, and I think...
They were American, right? They would have played at high school, so they might have had some sort of knowledge about the game.
They were actually really quite good and quite vicious as well, surprisingly. They were real foulers. But what we did was, we went into different community groups and said to people, come and play. You know, you don't have to bring anything. We've got boots if you want them. We've got shin pads if you want them. They didn't. You know, we'll teach you the rules if needs be. So the games initially were more like... They were proper games, but we would be teaching the rules as we went along, which was quite a nice way of doing it. And eventually the referees would become the local people who've been playing enough would start to want to referee and then want to be Lions people. So we would eventually create a sort of self-sufficiency there. But initially people just came and played and they were very late and they often just came with the wrong number of people, but it was a league. And so we decided it's me and Dilshan, who's like the main passionate person on the island.
Dilshan's the star of the book.
Yeah.
And I really want people to go and buy the book and read it. And they need to prepare themselves for the energy and the passion and the just star quality of your man,
he's
Dilshan.
Just an amazing guy.
Tell us a bit about him.
He's a Sri Lankan 20, I suppose he was early 20s at the time. And his family had moved from Sri Lanka during the Civil War and moved to Pompeii. So he found us off this tiny island.
Is that a regularly well-trodden path?
No. And it was very odd. I think, like a lot of people, they'd ended up there through complete chance. I think his dad was a teacher and had looked for a job and just found this job at the college there and just thought, I'll apply for it and see what happens, and got it.
Is it quite idyllic there? Sorry to cut in.
Yeah,
it's quite
beautiful. Yeah.
So you'd have a nice life there?
Yeah, it's an amazingly beautiful place. It's just shockingly, beautifully green everywhere, and there's like amazing ocean to the side. There's no beaches, no proper beaches, but there are like stone beaches. Absolutely beautiful.
I spent a bit of time in Fiji and the Cook Islands, and that felt like such a step change, even from when I was living in near Portsmouth at the time. The pace of life is so slow. It's almost like your brain clock, the pace of your brain has to completely readjust itself. So it must be like that.
It's exactly like that. And that's a really big part of acclimatization, was you would have schedules. You'd want everything done now. You know, I was coming from a London sort of life, and I was still thought you know, you set times, you stick to times. I wasn't disciplinarian in that way, as we said, because I was trying to be quite soft in my approach.
Yeah.
But I was staggered by how much everything slows down. And as you say, you go to meet someone and they're just not there at the time they say, and 2 hours later they might show up. And it's not a big deal. That's just, you know, you're on an island. Who
you just
cares?
Got to adjust.
You've got to adjust.
So Dilshan would seem to be like very on it, very keen.
Well, the great thing was Dilshan was my middle man. And this was why it worked perfectly. He was the link in that he knew all the island guys who'd been there, you know, for a long time. He knew them all. He even spoke sort of local language. He was respected and liked. And he had coached a lot of the young kids.
And he was genuinely good at football as well.
He was very good. And he could have been a professional cricketer, but they left, his family left Sri Lanka as he was. So he took up football then really quite late. And just was brilliant. Amazing free kick striker. And just all the players loved him. Really lovely man, like great guy. But this was the key thing, is I had this middleman who I could go have a beer with. We'd sit there and we'd chat ideas with each other. And if I suggested something that made sense in England but would be lunacy in Pompeii, he would very gently say, no, mate.
Like what?
Well, just anything, like, you know, the timing of the games. And I'd sort of say, well, let's have a 3 o'clock kickoff. And he'd say, some people might get sunstroke. I'd say, okay, is that, you know, is that silly? And he'd say, yeah, I mean, we don't really want anyone to die in the games, do we? I'd say, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right, when would you suggest? He'd say, maybe we'll start about 5 and we'll tell everyone it's kicking off at 3 because then they'll turn up at 5.
Yeah,
and, you know, these little things. And also shouting at players. You can't shout at players. It's just a massive cultural no-no,
right?
Especially older players. And these are rules you don't learn until you get there. So no. I think I did shout at someone late on, you know, 6 months into coaching them, I shouted at someone. And it wasn't a nasty one. It was a kind of, please stop sort of kicking the balls over that fence because we've got 3 balls left.
Yeah, okay.
And it turned out he was older than me and he walked off. And Dilshan was the guy who in the middle said, you've kind of committed a massive social faux pas, you're gonna have to go to him and apologize. And I did. And you know, you learn that way because you've got someone in the middle. Otherwise I would have just thought, what,
he's a bit sensitive. Yeah.
Well, good riddance.
He's gonna make it at this level.
Yeah, exactly. See what he does when Allardyce turns up.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it was great to have that middleman. So we set up the league and got people playing, and it was me and Dilshan marking out this pitch by hand with hand house paint.
And you got sunstroke doing that, did you not?
That was it. And so we did that, and we'd got 5 of the local lads who really wanted to do it, and we were starting to get on. We were, you know, I could feel I was starting to gain some trust. And so they were saying, well, when can we do it? And they said, well, we'll do it at 2 p.m. through to about 5. It takes about 3 hours. And they were saying, yeah, but you don't have to do it. You're the coach. You don't have to do it to me. And I was like, well, I can't. Like,
oh, yeah,
that's not who I am. Like, come on. So we all got out there with our paintbrushes, we're painting. I was thinking, this is hot.
How hot was it?
About 35 degrees. And, you know, I'm not terrible with heat, but you know when you've gone past. You know when you're done.
Yeah.
And I got that so early on, it was embarrassing. So I thought, well, look, I can't cry off after 15 minutes now. Yeah. I might as well see this thing through. How bad could it be?
Did you have your T-shirt off?
No. I probably would have died if I'd done that. Genuinely. I mean, I lost a lot of the skin off my arms, almost all.
Did you have sun cream on?
Yeah, I did, but it sun cream's useless in a place where it rains that much.
Oh, okay,
and that is
right.
So damp in the environment that it comes off.
Okay.
So I burnt to a crisp. I was just absolutely done. And I ended up getting boils, which are quite common on the island, but it's because the shower was sort of brown water and it wasn't quite clean where I had a shower.
Infected,
so basically. Infected. So I was coming back to the field thinking, they are going to think, who is this guy to be sort of trying to take charge? He's covered in, like, he's got boils on him, he's bright red, his skin's peeling off.
Yeah,
he just looks terrible.
Why didn't they say to you, look, boss, we can't do it during the day, let's do it at 8 p.m.
But you couldn't really do it a lot of the evening because it would either rain or there were no floodlights, so it went dark very early.
So you've got no choice, basically.
Got no choice. And plus they were working around their own work schedule, so I did really respect, you know, they had their obligations. I was just there to do football.
Right, okay.
So, you know, I don't think they did it to get me to burn, but they may have done.
Teach you a lesson.
Trial by fire.
Yeah, yeah.
But what it did do is when I did start showing up, people really kind of liked me a lot more. Because it was like, well, you know, this idiot
so you
was willing
something
to burn
from
himself
it.
To a crisp with us. Just
was it worth it?
To do it. I don't know. There's still actually a patch on my back that will never recover.
Really,
like the top of my neck, and I've still got very small bit. I've got a boil scar on this wrist and a boil scar on my knee.
Wow, okay.
Which will never go.
Serious.
So I see them as my sort of Pompeii.
Yeah.
I'm too much a wimp to get a tattoo. That's like my Pompeii tattoo.
Badge of honour. Yeah, absolutely. and so you. I mean, I don't want to give away the entirety of the book because I think that would be counterproductive, really, because I do think people should read it. But you take the team to Guam and you kind of achieve what you set out to achieve, and it's quite an uplifting story. Is there any, because I want to move on after the break to some of the stuff you've done more recently, but is there any, what's the current status in Pompeo in terms of football now? Is still a program happening there, or?
It is, yeah, and this is the frustration. It still really haunts me, to be totally honest. The whole plan is, you know, you don't want to go do something that's completely unsustainable, leave and it disappears.
Yeah, so we had to set up a legacy, right?
Yeah,
Dilshan was your man for that,
and that team of players that we eventually took away to Guam to try and get their first win. That team, every one of them was a coach by the end of it. Really
brilliant.
You know, they were
that's
willing
amazing.
To coach. But a lot of them then left the island because that's quite commonplace. They went off to get education. They went off to do what they needed to do. Dilshan included went off to the US to study law. In fact. So, you know, you're not going to stand in his way of that. But what it did mean is there's only a few of the guys now left on the island coaching. But football participation is still much, much bigger. It's grown every year a little bit since I left. So it's getting better. But there's still no sign of funding. There's no they're not allowed. They're not allowed to effectively any development funding because they can't get into either Oceania football or Asia football.
Because of this unification of the whole of Micronesia, which is logistically almost impossible.
Well, one of the problems is that, certainly, but they did, you know, one of the last things I was part of was setting up a Micronesian FA that had the islands all involved. So football actually on Yap is much bigger now than it ever was. So actually three of the islands, Yap, Chuuk and Pohnpei, are all playing football.
Great.
But they have to function as one island, one nation in FIFA's eyes. They did set up an FA, they did apply to AFC, and it took 7 years. And then they were told the application had taken too long, so it's been reset.
FIFA don't come out of this story very well.
They don't. And
it's
continued that way. So it remains a thing where I'm trying to help find coaches to go out there and do little stints and help work with the local coaches. But we just shouldn't have to be doing this.
No.
You know, it's crazy.
Especially as FIFA's sort of front and centre talking about how they want to take the game to everyone and they're for the good of the game.
We were watching World Cup matches with those signs saying, you know, for the game for everyone. And, you know, we develop football everywhere.
Football for all,
At the time, we were sending emails to the correct department in FIFA, the member development department, and being told, we will not respond to this email because you don't have the right structure in place.
Right, okay.
You know, genuinely, it was that kind of red tape was put in place of, you know, talk to us when you've got your six committees in place. And it's like, we're on a Pacific island here, you know.
They've got a bit of some sensitivity to the fact that you're in a complete catch-22 situation.
It's absolute catch-22, and it's hit that region, you know, Tuvalu, Kiribati. There's a handful of nations there, and it amounts to a few hundred thousand people who want to play football and are playing football, but they're not having any help in development. And as a result, a lot of kids won't get access to football in the way that
It's a shame. But not. I mean, you know, it's in spite of your best efforts as well, it should be said. You're the one who's tried to, more than anyone, to help them with that.
And keep it on going. I mean, it occurs to you every now and again. That's the thing. I never wanted it to be something that was about my own desires and transplanting them onto the people in that region.
No.
But the truth is, it's a sport that suits them really well. The stature is naturally quite short. People are generally about 5'8" is average, 5'6".
It's a cheap sport to get involved with
cheap
as well.
Cheap sport.
Yeah.
But they're all trying to play basketball a lot of the time, so it doesn't work well. Volleyball doesn't work so well. Football really does. Then the natural build is good for it. There's a massive problem with obesity there. It's the most obese place on earth, in fact, that little region.
Yeah.
Partly because kids play sport and then they get to a point where there's nothing more to do. There's no pathway. And so the really talented athletes have got nothing to aspire to. There's no best case scenario, so they give it up. And so I think there's a massive desire and need for football in the region, but you know, there's a limit to what can be done. Especially by, I just, you know, ran into debt through the project, basically, because
ten grand's
worth of debt, in fact. Which it took me a long time to. I only paid that off, I think, last year.
Wow!
And you know that's the reality of it. It was like a gambler. You know, if I stopped, I knew nothing was going to continue. So I had to keep going to a point where I thought it's going to continue.
Do you think you'll go back?
Yeah, I do actually. But what I'm most keen to do is help other people go there. You know, help other coaches, because it benefits both sides. You know, it really will benefit, obviously, the region to have coaches, even not that experienced coaches, but you know, probably more experienced than I was, but people who want to help get people play football in that region will make a massive difference. But also it will be a massive experience for them too, in the way that it was for me. It really broadened out my horizons, in that it made me see the many, many other factors of being involved in football. You know, I was drafting educational curriculums for school sports. I was trying to get kit deals. I was trying to do social media. I was trying to get a web presence. I was trying to lobby FIFA. What you'll get is this like experience where in England and in the UK, you know, coaches have so few opportunities to really get good jobs or any jobs, but certainly jobs where you get this kind of ability to get involved in all these different aspects of football. And I found I got fascinated by all these things I never knew I was even interested in. And what I love the thought of is coaches coming over from here for a short spell over there, and there's nothing off the table. You know, you could be involved in any facet of football you like, and they're going to bring their own experience, their own knowledge, but also they're going to learn a lot and have this kind of amazing sort of rounding experience.
Yeah, where, of course.
And I do, that's what I'm trying to set up now, because I just don't think the powers that be are going to get involved anytime soon. So it's going to have to be done at the effectively a grassroots level.
Yeah. Well, good on you. Look, we're going to take a little break, and then afterwards we're going to come back to talk to Paul some more. And I think this journey is going to take us next to Mongolia. So stick around for that.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to this episode of Ramble Meet, sponsored by Bet365. Paul, I mentioned just before the break there that you clearly felt that the travel bug hadn't been satisfied, and you've a few years later, or whatever, when was it? Kind of 2013 or whatever.
Yeah,
you ended up found yourself in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia.
Yeah,
which is a country that fascinates me generally. Anyway, tell us a bit about how you managed to find yourself there.
Was it, when I came back from Micronesia, there wasn't. Strangely, the phone wasn't ringing off the hook with so I sort of didn't really have anywhere to go for a little while football wise and wasn't sure what to do, and then got approached sort of out of the blue by a guy called Enki Batsumba, who sent me an email and said, would you be interested in coaching a new Mongolian football team? And obviously, yeah, I was. I mean, it for start, you know, as I say, I hadn't had a lot of other opportunities, but, and did love travelling. But also the idea of the team, he'd set it up to be the sort of anti-corruption team and to be the people's team.
Did your now wife go, oh, not again?
You know what, actually, the first time she was entirely supportive in Pompeii. This time she was supportive, but with a kind of resignation, a sort of,
this is how it has to be.
I think basically because she has a really good job here. And I think if she maybe didn't have a career, then it would be very different. We'd be going these places as a couple. But
yeah,
it is a real moment where you think, do I want to be away?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was different to Pompeii. It didn't have that kind of childish recklessness of it. It was much more reasoned, I suppose. I was thinking, well, look, I don't think I can get anywhere in England. Like, what I've done doesn't count for anything here.
What would you have liked to have done when you come back to England? Would you like to have become a coach?
I think so. At that time, I think I'd have loved to go and learn the ropes. That's what I really wanted, was to learn from coaches. Mm. And I found that very difficult because it was so about who you knew.
Yeah, of course.
I did meet a couple of lovely coaches who would let me watch sessions, who would talk to me about sessions. But generally speaking, it was quite a closed shop. And obviously what I'd done, I was under no illusions. What I'd done in Pompeii didn't put me on anyone's radar. Mm. But it's not like in football you can apply for assistant jobs.
No.
The assistant is obviously linked to the manager.
Yeah.
So it's unlike any other field in that way, in that there's not really a way that you can say, all right, I'm not up to coaching, you know, even at like, you know, we're looking like seventh, eighth tier level. Mm. You know I'm not up to coaching that team at that time. And I say, look, I'm not saying I should manage you, but is there a way I can be a sort of helper, secondary figure?
Yeah.
There just isn't a way of doing that. Yeah. So I found I had no contacts and was a bit frozen out. So when a team come and give you this opportunity and you think, well, yeah, you know, it's clearly something I'm not quite qualified to do, but at least I'll learn on the job. You know, like in Pompeii, I learned through all these mistakes and all this experience that I just wouldn't have got in England.
So what were the main differences then? It was presumably a lot more organised, a lot more professional.
Well, it was still quite chaotic, but in a very different way. So
right.
At the time, the Mongolian League was a mess. It was ridden by match fixing. Games were basically, no one was watching games, and same team won every year. They still do, actually. Urchim, who are the power plant team. Urchim Thermal Power Plant number 3.
Right.
Which I imagine for chance is just nightmare.
Yeah,
but luckily,
right.
That doesn't really come up because about 30 people
watches them. Okay. But is there interest among the general population?
Yeah. And that's the thing. And this is what I was brought in to do effectively and failed to do, but tried to do, was that the whole idea was we'd create a team where people would actually get behind the local players. It'd be like, you know, homegrown football, grassroots football, but trying to build local heroes for people.
Yeah.
Because at the time, and still now actually, fans went and watched Liverpool, Manchester United. They've organised fan clubs. It's quite amazing. Mm. They go out and watch these games in bars at weird times of day, and the bars are packed, and these people are going nuts. But they've never been to Manchester in the main, never been to Liverpool, but they are passionate.
Mm.
And yet when their champions are playing, when Urchim are playing, there's no one watching really. No one really cares. The national team do get some crowds, but it's still pretty minor.
And what kind of level are the national team?
They've been really struggling, but they've come up a lot.
Right.
They've got a really good coach now, a German coach, who's taking them, he's got them a lot more organised. But at the time, they were, again, right near the bottom of the rankings.
Right.
Their World Cup qualification was, I think, the first one, they were first elimination for the 2018.
Right.
They had East Timor over two legs, got beaten, and that
Blimey,
was it.
Really?
That's
okay.
Your qualification. So it was a depressing environment to be in as a homegrown football. But the fact that, you know, the captain of your national team can walk down the street and not have a single person even want a selfie with him. I know there's probably a good side to that too, but it felt to me like that I wanted to create something local that they could be proud of. And that's what this team that we were setting up was designed to do.
It's got a population of a few million, right? So you think there'd be resources there?
I think it's three and a half, something like that.
Okay.
So it's not a small country in a lot of ways. And, you know, having been one of the most powerful countries on earth at one time, or, you know, the Genghis Khan era. Mm. It's got a real sense of being an important country in a way that you wouldn't expect. Mm. But we had this idea of building this team of local players and trying to really celebrate local talent. And we did so in the end through a TV show, a reality TV show, a sort of American Idol of football, which came about because we went to try and find a sponsor, as we had no money. Mm. The sponsor was this soft drink that I probably can't name in case of legal reasons, because it was, to all intents and purposes, undrinkable. It was just awful. But
right.
This soft drink said, we will sponsor you as long as our parent company, who owned this TV channel, make a documentary about you finding these players. And it's sort of like a reality TV show, and you're drinking our soft drink all the time. So that was how, weirdly, we got a sponsor.
You
and
must
a TV
have
show.
Never thought your life's ever going to turn out like this.
No, and it was an appalling TV show. I don't think it exists online, luckily, but it must be the worst show ever made because barely anyone spoke English. Yeah. I didn't speak any Mongolian. When I tried to learn it, people laughed at me. One guy once said, not harshly, said, what you were saying, it wasn't awful, but it's like a dog is speaking. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, it's, you know, you don't expect your dog to try and talk to you. It's sort of like that. And I said, oh, right, but my pronunciation's good. And he said, it's not good, but I kind of know what you mean sometimes.
Right, right,
so I was
okay.
Like, oh, well, that's
It's a difficult language to learn.
It's really hard.
Is it based in Mandarin or
no? I think it's
Russian. Or?
It's got elements of Russian in there. But it's really different. I mean, there are sounds that we just don't naturally make. I think it's quite a notoriously difficult language.
Right, okay. But you were there for a few years, right? So did you make any progress with that at all?
A little tiny bit, but still never enough to feel confident. And that was a real frustration for me because it does make it very hard when you're always working through the few people who speak English.
They didn't give you a translator or anything like that?
Well, the guy who ran the club was effectively my translator because he did speak fluent English. He lived in the US for 10 years.
Right.
But then... that caused in itself its problems because it's like you know, Sarri trying to give a training session and Abramovich is translating it. You know,
sure,
he didn't necessarily have the football knowledge, but also he thought he did. So he had his own little views.
Right.
So you'd say something to a player who didn't speak English and then you'd see it being said again and you think, I don't think that's what I said to you. And he had these very clear views about what formations we should be playing and things like that. Yeah. And I'd be thinking...
But at the same time, you're thinking, but I've got no way of checking that.
Yeah, I had literally no way of checking. I'd just see the player gloss over a little bit. And, oh, my God. So, yeah, it had problems all the way down the line. But the TV show had its biggest problem in that the producer barely spoke any English. I barely spoke any Mongolian. And so they would just point a microphone at me and say, go. And I'd just try and do, usually in about minus 20 degrees, because it was the middle of the winter and we'd be outside, trying to do these links. But there was no one to edit them. So I just sort of just spoke.
I think people listening to this will sort of salute your indefatigability. You know, just the idea that you're not going to be deterred from this. You're going to push through and you're going to stick it out.
Well, you know, the weirdest thing was that in amongst all the mess of it, and it was really difficult a lot of the time, it was cold and as I say,
you've gone from sunstroke and boils to minus 20. Could you not find for your next project someone that's like a fairly temperate climate?
Exactly, right? Yeah. Like England.
Yeah.
This was the thing. I really struggled in that all elements of it. But in amongst it, we were doing this TV show and it was kind of rubbish. I mean, it was a circus and the actual show was nonsense. You know, they were saying to me as coach, what do you think we should do? Should we dribble round cones? And I was like, well, no, why don't we just play some games? Mm. And they were saying, okay, so first round is dribbling round cones. And I was like,
okay, right.
All right, fair enough. Yeah. So the show was rubbish. But in amongst that...
Did people watch it?
Yeah, I think they did. I think they did. I mean, in amongst that, you'd have these amazing players who would show up. And sometimes from crazy backgrounds, you know, come from the Gobi Desert from a nomadic family, had heard about it from someone in the village, had come all the way to play and was amazing. And you think, my God, these stories were there, like people who'd lived in the yurt district. So living in yurts, one of the kids had dreamt of being Wayne Rooney because, you know, he once got given a sticker of Wayne Rooney and so kicked a ball against a wall on his own before school at 6 a.m. in minus 15 degrees every day.
Yeah.
And he was good. I mean, he wasn't amazing, but he was good.
Yeah.
So you'd see these players and you think, God, I really do want to make this work.
Yeah. So you've got just enough there to keep you encouraged. Basically.
Exactly. And yet the show was rubbish because you'd have the producer saying to me, you know, you must be like Simon Cowell. And I'd say, right, okay. But you cannot be mean to anyone because we won't like that.
Right.
I'd say, right, okay. And then would say, you need to look like English gentleman. So I'd be like, okay, how do I look like an English gentleman? And he'd say, your hair must be like this. And he'd literally just grab my hair and put it into a side parting.
Right.
And that was basically that was the thing they really cared about, was that and that we had the drink in our hands the whole time.
Right, okay.
But everything else was just complete free-for-all. And so we'd have 50 kids just going around cones for purposes that were completely
irrelevant.
Useless.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was completely pointless. And then suddenly he'd say, which one are we picking? And it'd be like, I don't know. Let's wait until we actually see them play a game, especially because this guy's come from the Gobi Desert. He's come 300 miles on a horse.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll let him have a kick around.
Yeah, exactly.
We,
yeah, absolutely.
And so it was rubbish. But in amongst there was this really, there was a purpose to it that, you know, we were trying to give a nation homegrown talent that we would put on TV and say, you know what, you can be like this. Because what I heard time and time again from Liverpool fans and Man United fans and all this was, well, what's the point watching our players? They're rubbish. And also from young players was, well, we're not going to get anywhere. There's no players like me in the Premier League, are there? And you think, well, I suppose that's true. If you actually look at it, it's hard to have a role model if you don't have anyone
Of course, no, absolute representation is really important, but I suppose at least in Mongolia, they had an understanding that there were different standards of football, whereas in Pompeii, I don't want to go back over that kind of stuff, but in Pompeii, they didn't really have any grasp that a Champions League final would be a far higher standard than what they were playing themselves. Yeah. So you must have felt like you've gone along a little bit on that front.
Yeah, well, it was definitely a big step up. The talent level was really much higher. You know, people were really good. They play futsal most of the year because it's so cold.
Yeah.
So the touch and the technique was really, really strong. And as you say, they knew what Premier League football looked like. So they really did know where their strengths and weaknesses were a lot better. It was much more of a coaching challenge in that way. In Pompeii, as you say, I showed them our guys. Clips of videos of the World Cup final. I guess it must have been
2010. I think. Yeah, yeah.
And some of them, quite honestly, looked at it and said, "Yeah, you know, we're about as good as them." And some of the others were sort of looking at it and saying, "Well, you know, this is far too good. There's no way we should, you know, Guam are going to be about as good as this, aren't they? So we shouldn't go to Guam, really."
Were you surprised at that?
No, it was exactly summed up that reaction. The island mentality was, it was very hard because you're in such a tiny pool that if you become the best at something, you either, your ego gets blown completely because there's nowhere to go with that.
Yeah.
Or the opposite sort of happens when you start looking at off-island competition.
Yeah.
They presume everyone in Guam is better than them at everything because...
Right. It's kind of a little brother kind of syndrome.
Yeah, I mean, they've only ever known defeat, not just in football as well, like in most sports, in most sports, not in every sport, but they've generally only seen teams get beaten. Mm. So they think, well, everyone's better than us. And then every now and again, they get a moment where they're winning 7-0 against the team that we used to play against called the Island All-Stars. Mm. It was any foreigner we could convince to kick a ball around, including sort of 45-year-old who's just had a knee operation because we needed opposition.
Yeah.
And they're winning 7-0. And the players are all starting to do these little step-over tricks. And they're coming off the field.
They've made it, yeah. Yeah,
and it's like, oh, you know.
So going back to Mongolia, what happened with Bayern goal in the end then? I mean, because you were there for a decent amount of time. I believe that you had to deal with fraudulent agents and all sorts of stuff went on. It was a lot more sinister, wasn't it, than what you were used to back in the Pacific?
It got very dark in a lot of ways. So we, by a series of quite complex processes, we did have a team that was decent enough. We went into the second division, which is your sort of entry level. Mm. Well, technically it was the third division, but we won that. It was a sort of cup. We won that, got into the second division. And
you're coaching them? You're the head coach?
Well, no, at this time I had stopped coaching them and I had effectively become the owner of the team because what we decided was best for the team was we'd have these two local coaches who were really good players, good coaches, and we would sort of use them to champion local talent. And it made sense. You know, we were getting them to go through their AFC badges. They were good young coaches. They were better coaches than I was, I'm sure. But they also understood the players. They could speak to them. So they became the coaches. And I'd sort of stepped upstairs effectively, partly because I'd had to be so involved in the way we kept the club running. And
upstairs already so early in your
career. I know. Yeah. And yet moved upstairs at a Mongolian club. It was very weird. But I effectively did it by default because the club had no way of paying me properly. You know, we were falling. The club was in such chaos that I was like, well, I'm doing a lot of the running of the club.
Mm.
And I say owning, I mean, there was nothing to own. It had no value. So there was no financial side to it. There isn't like a marketable value on the club. So I effectively was sort of, we had the coaches, we had me and Enki who were effectively running the club. And what happened was, we were in the second division. We finished in the playoffs and lost on away goals, even though both games were played at the same venue. They were all played in the same stadium. We lost on away goals. And we didn't know that they were using the away goals rule.
Oh, really?
Until after the final whistle when both teams... Well, we were celebrating because we won on the day and we thought, well, it's going to extra time. And we sort of clawed it back. And so the players were patting each other on the back.
Right.
Like, come on, we can do this. Their players were celebrating because they were like, well, we've just won.
Why do you think you didn't know? Did they not tell you?
The federation was a little bit disorganised.
Right, okay. It wasn't corrupt. It was just
No one had a clue what was going on.
Okay, right.
And eventually it emerged, they were up. And my overall feeling was relief because we had tried to build this kind of like, you know, grassroots-based, like small club. But the Premier League, you know, people might chuckle, but the Premier League did have what to us was quite big money being passed around. People were starting to buy in. The way people win the title is they buy in players from Nigeria, even Spain and sort of, you know, Croatia and places like that.
Right.
Buy them in for a season, which they treat kind of like doing a ski season or something, you know. Come in, win the league, go off.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't really want to get into that because our team just wasn't up to it. We thought, let's give it another year, let's build. And then we got the message 10 days before the season, the next season was supposed to start, that we'd been promoted. Because one of the teams refused to take their place.
Right.
I think because of what we were thinking. So we said, well, look, we don't really want this place. And they said, no, you have to take it. You have to take it. You have two
choices.
And
you were committed to only doing homegrown players. You're like almost like an Athletic Bilbao kind of
exactly. Fight. This was our model. Yeah. So they said, well, look, you've got 10 days, but you have to take this place or we'll relegate you back down past the other division. So we have to go back to third division, effectively. So we took it on. And that was when it all went awry, basically, because from that point on, we were just completely outmatched by the clubs in that division. But more than that, we really struggled because we marked ourselves out as an ethical club. And so we started getting, we were the go-to people. If things were going wrong at other clubs, people would come to us and say, look, can you help us? And we really wanted to help them.
Right.
So we had two Nigerian players who showed up to training one day and we said, look, you know, what can we do for you? So, well, can we come and play for you? We said, well, you've got clubs, you know, you're playing for a club. I said, no, we've been told our visas aren't legitimate. The club said, we're going to sort your visas out. They haven't. The club's now saying, you've got to play for us anyway for the rest of the season, and then we'll get you out of the country safely. We're saying, well, that is effectively kind of blackmail. It's effectively trafficking.
Apparently
it's very common practice in that region, is that clubs bring in these players, promise to like look after their immigration status, but as soon as they become illegal immigrants, the players have nothing they can do. So these guys were sleeping in a park because the club had refused to pay them.
And they've got no recourse.
And the only way they thought, the only way that they had of securing their safety in their eyes was, well, we play for this club to the end of the season, do well, and then maybe they'll honour their word and get us out of here safely. So we said to them, no, we'll sign you effectively. You know, we'll bring you in. We put them up in a house. We got them a new apartment. But then obviously we couldn't play them. So we had these two players that were illegal players because they had no immigration status. So the league said, well, you can't play them, which we knew. So we had two players on our books who were unable to play, but we were looking after them.
So it became almost like a sanctuary for them, essentially.
Exactly. And we tried to negotiate with the embassies to make sure that they would be safely allowed to leave the country. But we were told, no, they'll have to serve a spell in prison.
Blimey. Is that what happened?
No, in the end, we paid a bribe.
Right, yeah.
Fly them out. Okay. Yeah. But these things effectively, we just couldn't deal with them financially, you know, the amounts of money. But we found ourselves in a difficult position because we marked ourselves out as being, you know, this is the club that's going to be ethical. And
is a soft drink company still funding you at this point?
No, at this point they pulled out.
So who's funding you at this point?
Nobody. And this is where it all started to get very difficult, is the money was effectively coming through me, Enki, the owner, and another guy who called Jimmy, who is a guy from the US who just emailed me, said, I really want to get involved.
Right.
I said to him, you probably don't.
Save yourself.
But he really did. And so we'd have him on Skype, me on Skype, Enki, you know, we'd have all these people, because I was kind of going to and from Europe and Mongolia. And it was a crazy period, this club being run from all these different places and had set this goal of being, you know, we're going to look after the ethics of football, and just didn't have the resources to do it. So looking after those players and getting them out of the country almost bankrupt the club. And the rest of the damage was done by the fact we didn't have a strong enough squad. And then we lost our two coaches, weren't allowed to coach us in the Premier League because they were also playing for a team in the Premier League. So that was never part of our plan, was we weren't supposed to go up. Suddenly we were up, lost both our coaches, had to have a licensed coach in place by the time the season kicked off in 10 days.
Yeah.
So we brought in a guy called Shadab Iftika, who is from Preston. And basically we put out an application set on Twitter, said that we need a coach really fast. He applied. He had this incredible CV. He'd worked with Roberto Martinez and Benitez. He was a brilliant coach, A-licensed coach, clearly overqualified. I said in an interview, you know, phoned him up and said, nah, there's no way you want to do this. You know, this is crazy. But if you do, we'll have
come.
You.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was on the next flight. He said I think he was in Asda. And then he just got up his phone and put up Skyscanner and he was out. And so he became our coach, and he was the poor guy who was wrestled with this task of trying to get us to stay up in a division we were clearly outmatched by.
Kind of like Rafa Benitez at the moment.
Yeah, a lot like that. A lot like that, except we were down. But, you know, he did an amazing job, and he dealt with some things you should never have to deal with. You know?
Yeah.
We were getting... We had to borrow the training pitch at Urchin, the champions, because we couldn't afford a pitch of our own. And they were really nice about it, and we were never sure why. But actually, it was because we were getting loads of media. So they were trying to, like, say, well, look, they would gently say, you know, maybe you can get us some of your media.
Yeah.
We never did. But and so they would just kick him off the training pitch halfway through a session.
Right. And say, okay. And you're still running in this, as this kind of ersatz owner at the time.
Yeah. So okay. I'm the one having to apologise to the coach who's just living this nightmare for right. like any organised coach. It's like everything is going wrong at every level, you know, from sort of, yeah, from the fact that our players aren't good enough, the fact our players, you know, can't even have a training session without being thrown off the training field, and there's no real solution to that. Mm. And so he did amazingly. There's no way he would have had to coach someone like Mongolia if there wasn't such a massive racism problem in English football. That's the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
When I saw his CV and I said, well, why are you applying for this job? You know, we can pay you $500 a month.
Yeah.
You're going to live in Mongolia. Like, honestly, your CV's too good for this. And he was saying, you know, no, I want to do it. I want to do it.
Okay, right.
And it's only later on when you sort of see it becomes quite clear he's not getting any opportunities in the UK because he has a Muslim name and he has a beard and he's Asian and that people are not are put
that's
off
a
by
been a barrier
that's the reality of it. I think, and for a long time I was quite naive about that, but I think I've seen some of the jobs he's applied for and been refused and thought, like, this is not even getting interviews for jobs where you know, he's clearly overqualified. And so that was we were very lucky to get him, but he was a brilliant character to have in Mongolia. Sort of the most typical sort of football, real football lover, football person, just dealing with this crazy world where the Federation didn't realise there was an international week one week and he had to tell them.
Okay,
this
right.
kind of world where,
right, okay.
And I think he loved it in his own way, that he's just like, how is this country, how does it work?
Yeah.
But in some way it really suited him.
So you've moved on from Mongolia now. Did you leave under a cloud, or was it difficult to part ways? What was the situation?
No, I mean,
came to the end of the line.
It was a very difficult season that, and we shut it down after that. Me and Jimmy, who had done most of the running, just took the decision that the club had to stop functioning, because really there was no money. It would have to continue coming from our pockets. We don't have any money to put into it. But also, we didn't feel that a club could function in that Premier Division and nurture young talent.
Yeah.
I still feel that, because every team is just bringing in six Japanese players, six Nigerian players.
Yeah.
So it's a 10-year, 15-year process to really start to change that mentality. But there's no real way that we were going to be able to do that, I think, because no one was going to sponsor us. We'd set ourselves up as anti-corruption. So, you know, the time that we helped those two players out, the two clubs that were responsible for those players despised us, but also had people who were within the Federation. So we just made enemies.
Mm. So long term, it was not really viable.
No, and I think that's always the problem. If you mark yourself out, I mean, we never called ourselves an anti-corruption club, but if you mark yourself out as an ethical club, you are effectively throwing stones at everyone else in the room, aren't you?
Sure. So, you're automatically accusing them of being corrupt.
Precisely. Yeah, so as I say, when you look after players they've maybe treated badly, they're not going to think, oh, good on you, you know, we've learned the error of our ways. Next time we get a chance and we're in that Federation meeting, we're going to make sure you get done for this.
Yeah,
done
okay.
for that. And that happened all the time, you know, with our yellow cards and our red cards, and we were just getting blitzed. But, you know, everyone always thinks that about their club, but genuinely we were not very welcome in Mongolia, really.
People who've been listening for the last 45 minutes or so will know by now that you're not a man to sit still for very long.
Mm.
And so now we come up to the present, I think, which is your work with Kanifa, for want of a better phrase, and I'm sure you'll clarify it, a kind of alternative FIFA, would you say? I was at a Kanifa World Cup game last summer at Bromley. Great to watch, great to be there, and that's all you're doing. You're providing football and tournaments and legitimacy for teams or groups of people who maybe don't have the recognition elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's not all. I came in. It was founded in 2013. I came into Kanifa in, I think, 2017. So I came in after the Mongolia experience had ended, and I'd obviously had an eye on non-FIFA football for a long time. And when I was in Pompeii, there was only this really sketchy organisation called the NF Board, the Nouvelle Fédération Board, based in Belgium, and they were just very odd, difficult people to deal with. But I got the impression it was mostly a keyboard thing; like there wasn't very much actual action there. So when I heard about Kanifa being launched, I kept an eye on it, and it was clearly something a bit more serious, well organised. And
give us an idea of the type of teams that will be involved.
So you got Abkhazia, for example, and so you've got Abkhazia, Transnistria, you've got Nagorno-Karabakh. So you may not know necessarily of those. I don't think I did before I joined, but these are kind of semi-recognized states that mm-hmm. exist. Those are all based in Europe, but, you know, believe themselves to be autonomous, rule themselves, but are sort of frozen zones where they're not internationally recognized. Mm-hmm. Somaliland, similarly, is effectively ruling itself, but is regarded as part of Somalia by the US, the UK, the rest of the world.
And you've got a similar situation with Matabeleland, is it? Part of Zimbabwe?
Well, Matabeleland's part of Zimbabwe. Yeah. So so the other thing that CUNIFA represents is nations, states and peoples. So it can be a UN-recognised nation in some case, you know, Tuvalu, that the places that we mentioned in the Pacific yeah. that can't get in, they can come into
CUNIFA. They're eligible as well.
But you also have minorities, ethnicities, often persecuted peoples. So as you say, Matabeleland, you've got the Ndebele people who were the people that were massacred by Mugabe, effectively. Mm. They suffered the genocide. Mm. They can represent themselves through our model. Similarly, the Rohingya can compete as the Rohingya rather than they would have to be Myanmar or, yeah. you know, which they just wouldn't do. Tibet, yeah. so Tibet's probably the one, the yeah, poster yeah. boys for us yeah. in a way. So, you know, Tibet are able to compete in our system. They would never compete in FIFA's. And so that's what CUNIFA does. And I joined the organisation basically because I believed we should bring a World Cup to London. I said, you know, I've got an idea of how we can do this. Contacted Sasha, who's the Secretary General, who does pretty much everything. He's yeah. absolutely...
And this is a labour of love for you both.
For all of us, yeah, okay. all of us. So Sasha's a football shirt collector who collected all the FIFA shirts and then collected all the non-FIFA shirts. And when the NF board, the past organisation, basically blew up in this massive sort of argument at their AGM, nothing existed. So Sasha just started emailing the people he got shirts from and said, you know what, let's set up a new one.
Yeah.
And he has become this kind of expert on international geopolitics, and he's sort of the person who binds it all together. But now we've got, 54 members across the world, away from sort of indigenous people in Australia, all the way over to, you know, Cascadia in the west coast of the USA. And yeah. it's
a fascinating project.
It's kind of... it's a real labour of love. As I say, we're all volunteers and we're constantly struggling to make it happen. But my passion was to bring this World Cup to London. I just thought, you know, this is the best place we could do it. Mm. And that became sort of 8 months, I guess, of maybe 10 months of work, and just the chaos that comes with organising a tournament, the visas, the accommodation. And we set out, you know, to do it in non-league stadiums, but, you know, non-league stadiums with a bit of a soul to it, you know, clubs that meant something. Mm. And so we ended up at, you know, places like Enfield Town, who are amazing, Bromley, as you say, Sutton, Carshalton, you know, all over. And it was and Slough
all,
and Bracknell.
They were all open to the idea of being involved.
Yeah, they all were. We had varying levels of excitement from different clubs, but the Enfield Town were amazing. They really championed it. They have a massive Northern Cypriot community there, mm-hmm. and they're one of our teams. Mm-hmm. So North Cyprus, basically, it was like a home game for them.
Yeah, they lost in the final, there. Did they not?
They did. The final was a terrible results. Game. Yeah. It was an amazing tournament, and the final was this dismal 0-0 draw, but we had 4,000 people pretty much there.
Amazing.
I think officially we had less than that.
That's amazing.
But it was like this packed event, and, you know, that was what was lovely, seeing the Tibetan community come out, seeing hundreds of Tibetans like banging Tibetan drums, singing folk songs. The Tamil community were brilliant, and you know, that's what I loved, was people celebrating their identity, and that is effectively what CUNIFA tries to do, is just give people whose identities are forbidden in the FIFA model a way to say, well, I want to play for this identity, that's who I am. And in a way it sounds very simple, but it actually creates just a world of headaches.
It's really interesting that obviously I meet lots of different types of people doing this type of show, and to me it feels it's quite warming, really, and fulfilling to know that football for you is a way to champion the downtrodden, champion people that are forgotten about, and you're using football in a way to try and lift everyone that you can, right? It's not for you, it's not a case of, oh, do you know what, I love football, so I want to get a free ticket to the Champions League final and watch and all that. You actually do use football in a really positive way, I think, like no one else I've met.
That's really nice of you to say. I suppose I don't really think of it that often. I mean, it's just the bit of football that appeals to me is seeing people feel like they are able to express themselves, and I guess
it can be a force for good, right? Among all the corruption, among all the multi-millionaire billionaire owners, it can also still in 2019 be a real force for good in the world.
It can, and I think that's why we keep doing it. As I say, like, you know, we all do it alongside our day jobs. We're constantly fighting battles. The London World Cup, it was 6 months of it felt like just smacking your head against a wall.
Yeah.
It was one problem after another. Even during the tournament, if anyone saw me during the tournament, I looked like a wreck. I looked I looked a mess because you're taking on all these responsibilities. You have none of the backup that you get with any FIFA event.
Yeah.
Everything was to the edge financially. Everything, you know, anything could go wrong at any point.
Mm.
And that's the reality, is as soon as you take on this project, it sounds, Kenefa sounds very uncontroversial in certain ways. I mean, you know, some of our teams are Yorkshire and Cornwall, you know, it's just, you know, if you feel that is your identity, then represent, let that give you a chance to represent that. But then you actually look at just simply every time you want a sponsor, you also allow Tibet to be in there. So no one who deals with China wants to touch you.
Right.
You know, everything, everywhere you go, you had embassies trying to stop this tournament in London. We had the Home Office didn't really want it to happen. They tried to stop visas. You had just every problem you could throw. And all we're really trying to do is say to people, you know, you feel you're Tibetan, play for Tibet.
Mm.
And I know it sounds very naive, but it's why as an organisation we'll always be the underdogs. We'll always be short of money and we'll always be struggling because you can't have it two ways. You can't be sort of bankrolled by Qatari millions and also be sort of thinking about the soul of football.
Is it fair to say that you are attracted to a football-based project with as many barriers in place as possible?
I don't naturally look for that. I think it's just, it's always been that way with the projects I've gravitated towards. I've always looked for things that I believe in, and I'm a bit of a sucker for causes. I think, you know, I am. It's the irony of Kenefa is that we're apolitical technically. We don't actually make political stances.
No.
But it's just simply the fact we exist and we're allowing to
play. Can be seen as one.
It's pretty clear that there is a sort of element of politics there.
But you're not passing judgment on the situation there. You're saying this is a people who identify themselves as this, and so they should be able to represent themselves.
Yeah, but that difference is so fine, isn't it?
We weren't
saying free Tibet, but we allowed a Tibetan flag to be raised at a match, and for the Chinese government, that's a tiny distinction.
In this environment, the simplest of actions can become a political statement, effectively.
It really can. And I think I understand why it doesn't exist in the FIFA model. I think it can't. You even get someone like Pep sort of mention his view on Catalan independence, and it becomes already a little bit of an issue. And you understand that because it's not that footballers don't have views and don't have ethics. It's simply a massive network of sponsorships. And you know, a footballer could say one thing about, you know, wherever, Tibet, and they could lose 400 grand's worth of sponsors in a day, theoretically.
Yeah.
And I'm not the person who's going to say they should be doing that. It's totally understandable they don't. And I think that's why you also need us as a complementary model that says, you know what, we're allowing people to represent those identities. But that doesn't mean we don't believe the FIFA model works or that it should exist. But it does very much mean that we're the ultimate marketable, unmarketable concept, in that everyone who hears it thinks, oh yeah, you know, that makes sense. I'm sure you'll sort of make that work. And then the reality is you scratch down and you think at every turn, the bigger powers don't really want this to happen. You know, that it's not easy to find either finance or support from governments, or, you know, it's difficult.
But you mentioned at the top of this that it's 10 years in July that you went to Pompeii for the first time.
Yeah.
And so the last 10 years presumably haven't been boring.
No.
So what do you want to work on next? What's next on the list?
Well, it's
football on the moon, presumably.
Would be logical.
Yeah.
I feel the moon has been so underrepresented.
Be a better climate than Pompeii, presumably.
Could you imagine? Yeah. I feel like that will happen eventually, but it'll be one of those ones like they play the Super Cup on the moon.
Yeah,
I can imagine that.
Someone's already played golf up there, of course. it wouldn't be the first sport.
It'd be one of those ones where you make that your fortress as a club.
It'd be a tough away trip, that.
You can imagine
250,000 miles each way.
You can imagine Pochettino sort of mumbling, well, it's not ideal to have to go to the moon on a Tuesday night, but, you know.
And I'm worried about the muscular atrophy of the players, you know. But seriously, what are you going to do next?
Well,
because I think I'd be interested. I think we'd be all here at the Ramble be very interested.
There's always new projects. And I think with Kenefa, you know, we're still very much active, and we've got our World Cup in Somaliland next year. We've got our Euro in Nagorno-Karabakh, which is probably very Googleable, I imagine.
Right, so you're taking the Kenefa World Cup next year, so it'd be every 2 years.
2020.
To Somaliland.
Somaliland.
And you're running that?
I'm not personally, but that's where it'll be.
Wow, that sounds really
interesting.
And
we are building towards the first Women's World Football Cup, which is
great.
Long overdue, but that should be next year as well. But then in terms of my own personal plan, I'm very much getting more involved in a way in the Pacific, in that I'm really trying to find the framework to start sending more coaches over to that region to have that experience that I had. And just not to give up this fight, that, you know, this very relatively small part of the world, but amazing part of the world, just can't continue to be ignored. And I think however little it feels that I can do, it just takes a few people to think, well, you know, I'll go out and
give it a go. Yeah.
Give that a go. And, and who knows, I'd love one day to think that, you know, you'd have some support for football in that region, and maybe even their own competitions and qualifiers, and
the Paul Watson Cup. Happen. Could happen.
I'd make them call it that.
And the cup
itself would be exactly my shape. It'd be my full size replica of me in gold.
No, in red, because you're still fully sunburned.
Yeah, the sunburnt me. Scare any player lifting it.
Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been absolutely fascinating. No exaggeration to say the most fascinating one we've done of these in a long, long while. So people listening should go out and buy Up Pompeii. It's Pohnpei. Paul's story about his frankly ridiculous trip and stay, trying to found football again on a small Pacific island. Keep in touch with him online. You're Paul underscore C Watson on Twitter.
I wasn't the first Paul Watson.
No, okay, right. Yeah, absolutely. And please do support Kanifa as well, because they do some fine work for a lot of people who just want to play football and aren't able to. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we'll hope to catch up with you again soon. This episode of Ramble Meets was sponsored by Bet365.
This was a Radio Staccato production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.